This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Dershowitz may think of his clients as underdogs, but the public doesn't necessarily agree. Many of his clients are rich and famous and privileged. He's represented Leona Helmsley, Michael Milken, Jim Baker, Mike Tyson, and Klaus von Bülow. The movie Reversal of Fortune was based on Dershowitz's book about the von Bülow case. Dershowitz is now consulting with Mia Farrow on her case against Woody Allen. Even before Dershowitz became famous for representing famous people, he was famous for taking on unpopular causes which represent larger civil liberties issues. For instance, he supported the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. Dershowitz specializes in civil liberties cases. He's also a law professor at Harvard. His new book, Contrary to Popular Opinion, is a collection of his recent newspaper columns. In the introduction, he writes, "I am difficult to chart on the conventional left, right, liberal, conservative continua."
Well, I'm not a conventional leftist. Obviously, I come from a left tradition. I'm a civil libertarian. I'm easy to place on that spectrum. I'm a strident civil libertarian, maybe even an extremist civil libertarian. I believe in absolute free speech. Well, actually, I call myself a relative absolutist on free speech because I can theoretically imagine a case for censorship, but I've never seen one. I've never seen a compelling case for censorship. I try very hard, this probably will sound a little audacious, but I try very hard to think through every issue from first principles. I don't belong to any clubs. I'm not a groupthink person, and I'm not politically correct.
What are your criteria for taking on a controversial case with a defendant who is a celebrity or very much in the public eye?
Well, first of all, I have the same criteria for taking on a case involving a celebrity or a non-celebrity. The vast majority of my cases involve obscure people, people on death row, people with no money. Recently, a woman whose children were taken away from her on charges of sexual abuse, in which we were able to prove that she did not, but somebody else sexually abused the children. Those are my typical cases. My criteria is the same. I have to feel that there was a terrible injustice done to the defendant. I don't have to think that the defendant is innocent. I don't have to think that the defendant is nice, but I have to feel that there was an injustice. I also have to feel this is a case that I can use in my classroom teaching, and it's a case that I can bring my classroom experience into the courtroom. It has to be something that fits me like a glove, and I turned down a great many fascinating cases involving very famous celebrities because they don't fit. I get 100 cases offered to me for every one that I take, and so I have an ability to select, pick my cases. So those are essentially the criteria. I take 50% of my cases on a pro bono basis. That's been a rule that I've had in my office since the time I started to practice. And beyond that, I will turn down no case ever because of the unpopularity of the defendant or what the defendant is accused of doing.
Do you ever worry that having become something of a celebrity lawyer and have taking on clients like Jim Baker and Klaus von Bülow, that people have become cynical about you as a publicity hound?
Oh, sure. There's no question about that. That's the risk you take. On the other hand, those are great cases. Klaus von Bülow, the ability to turn around public opinion in this country, everybody was sure he was guilty and would be convicted, and we were able to demonstrate that if you give somebody a new trial and bring in all the evidence, a jury will find that person not guilty. It was one of the few publicly known cases where a constitutional right turned a case around from a guilty verdict to an innocent verdict, and I think it really undercut in the mind of many people the notion that these are mere legal technicalities.
What about Leona Helmsley, Jim Baker? What were your reasons for taking them on?
Well, Jim Baker, let's take him first. He got a 45-year sentence, and we got that sentence reversed on the basis of a holding by the United States Court of Appeals that the judge had engaged in religious bigotry by enhancing his sentence because the judge disagreed with the religious beliefs of Jim Baker. And if you can do it to Jim Baker, who is obviously not very well-liked, not my kind of person, you can do it for anybody. And that was a very important civil liberties issue involved in that case. Leona Helmsley, I really believe, was a victim of a combination between the media and the prosecutor's office. They both played off each other. They try to portray her as the Queen of Mean, as somebody whose description rhymes with witch. By the way, I thought there was a lot of sexism involved in that case. When a man is tough and aggressive in business, they don't use that B word to describe him. Indeed, they have only complimentary words to describe him. And yet Leona Helmsley was always described very negatively, and I believe there was a selective prosecution. She would not have gotten 4 years in prison if she had not been the queen of mean and somebody who was so loathed by members of the community. And I thought there was a very important issue in that case. There was also a very important double jeopardy issue in that case, and we won that. We got all the state charges against her dismissed on grounds of double jeopardy. By the way, that clearly relates to some of the most compelling cases today, the Rodney King case, where I believe the police should not be tried again, even though I think there was a terrible miscarriage of justice. That again shows you, I think, my position, hard to chart. Most liberals would say that there was a miscarriage of justice in the Rodney King verdict, and therefore police should be tried again. I don't buy the therefore. There was a miscarriage of justice, but there is a double jeopardy clause, and that interferes with trying him again, and we won that in Leona Helmsley's case, and it was a very important victory.
Isn't the trial of the police officers in the Rodney King case the Justice Department?
Of course it is, and that's the same, to me, why it's so compelling. The United States Supreme Court has erroneously ruled that if another sovereign tries somebody for the identical conduct, that somehow circumvents the Bill of Rights. By the way, the ACLU changed its policy to allow it to support that second prosecution. They had always previously had a policy of opposing a second prosecution by a different sovereign. And if you think of the implications of that for civil liberties, they're quite scary. What will happen in the second Rodney King case? The same exact piece of evidence, the same videotape, will be shown to different jurors, and they'll be asked to come to a different verdict on the same evidence. It is double jeopardy, pure and simple.
What are some of the obstacles to handling a case where parties are celebrities, where the case becomes a public case, you know, where people are reading about it in the newspaper and in magazines, where mobs of spectators and press show up whenever there's a hearing?
I've handled cases involving celebrities that you've never heard of and you'll never hear of. I'll go to my grave with those secrets, because we've managed to keep them out of the glare of publicity. And when we want to keep something out of the public eye, we are pretty successful at doing it, provided that both parties agreed.
Do you think that celebrities want to be represented by somebody in the celebrity class?
I think they make a mistake when they pick their lawyer on that basis. And I've turned down a number of celebrities who wanted me because they thought I would add some kind of celebrity or glamour to their case. That's not the criteria to take a case. I'll give you one example of a case I turned down. Mostly I can't tell you about cases I turned down because that's confidential. But Pamela Smart announced that I had turned down her case, so I'm free to discuss it. She's the woman who was accused of hiring her or getting her boyfriend to kill her husband in New Hampshire. And the issue in that case on appeal was going to be whether there was unfair pretrial publicity. And I was very frank with her, and I said, look, don't hire Alan Dershowitz to bring a case challenging publicity. It just isn't a good mix, because I'm generally in the case to try to level the playing field, to try to bring positive publicity to my client after my client has been savaged by negative publicity. Get a good, nice, quiet, discreet, dignified lawyer to handle your appeal in this case. He or she will be able to bring more credibility to the issue of pretrial publicity than I could. So I turn down a lot of cases because I'm not the right person. I never take a case where a client asks me to play up to the lawyer, to the judge, to ask for a favor, to do anything behind the scenes, to be part of the old boy, the old girl network. That's not me. I recommend lawyers who can do that. I take cases where the kind of talents that I hope I have work to the benefit of the client. And if I ever take the wrong case, that's the worst thing a lawyer can do, is take a case that that lawyer is not suited for. And I've seen so many disasters when lawyers take on cases where they're good lawyers, but this is not the right case for them.
My guest is Alan Dershowitz, and he's written a new book called Contrary to Popular Opinion. It's a collection of his recent essays. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Lawyer Alan Dershowitz is my guest, and he has a new book called Contrary to Popular Opinion. I want to get back to the subject of political correctness. Mm-hmm. You say that on the left, when people talk about diversity, really diversity is being used as a code word for something that's not about diversity
at all. Absolutely, absolutely. Nobody I know on the left who claims to want diversity would enthusiastically vote for an evangelical Christian fundamentalist to join the Harvard Law School faculty. Now that would give us real diversity. Nobody I know would vote enthusiastically for a active member of the National Rifle Association or a strong supporter of the right to life or some other people, a Hasidic Jew, a fundamentalist Hasidic Jew. What they want are people who fit their political profile. They want more of them. They want to replicate themselves. That is the exact opposite of diversity. What they want is political power, and they want to use the concept of diversity to achieve political power. The last thing they want is true diversity, people who would bring new intellectual perspectives and approaches to a place like Harvard Law School. And but I've told that's true in other universities as well.
What's your posture on the issue of diversity in the law school?
I support diversity. I would love to see really more diverse views, but diversity means blacks who think like blacks and blacks who think like whites and women who think like women and women who think like men. And the one thing I don't want and can't tolerate is a system where we discriminate against women and blacks, who we've discriminated against for years, by requiring of them and not of white males that they pass a litmus test. We don't require white males to pass a litmus test of whether they not only are white males, but they have to think like white males, but we require blacks and women under this political correctness doctrine to pass a political litmus test, that they not only provide racial diversity, but that they also agree with the political perspective of those who are pushing their appointments.
Don't you think that that kind of, you know, quote, politically correct litmus test is sometimes in reaction to a previous litmus test that's been issued by, say, an administration who's looking for a certain, a black faculty member or a black judge or something, because there's that suspicion that they've found, like, the one out of 1,000
sure.
Black people whose thoughts would really coincide with the white establishment that's hiring them.
I can understand that when it comes to, say, an appointment of a Clarence Thomas. You've described exactly why President Bush appointed Clarence Thomas. He searched through that haystack and found the one needle of a stealth candidate who clearly, although black racially, was against affirmative action, was against a whole range of issues that are important to the black community. That hasn't happened at Harvard Law School. Nobody has gone out to look for African Americans who think like whites or women who think like Phyllis Schlafly. In fact, we don't have any on the faculty, so I don't believe that it is a reaction to that. I think it's a power grab, and it's a power grab in the name of diversity, and that's why I'm opposed to it.
Okay, something else you've said about political correctness, that there's a double standard, that women and blacks are entirely free to attack white men, radical
right.
feminists can accuse
right.
all men of being rapists, but radical African-Americans, and radical African-Americans can accuse all whites of being racist, but whites can't parody blacks. Whites can't say bad things about blacks. Men can't say bad things about women.
Absolutely correct, and it's understandable. It's affirmative action in the area of speech. Basically, what it says is, look, men have been sexists for so long and whites have been racists for so long that it's okay for women to be a little sexist and for African Americans to be a little racist. In response, we have to really be a little tolerant. It's paternalistic. And I refuse to be paternalistic to my African American friends, to my women friends. I'm going to treat them absolutely equally. And whatever the rule is for white males in terms of free speech, and it should be totally broad and totally permissive, the same rule should apply to women, to African Americans. And I believe that at a university, anything goes in terms of speech. You know, people tell me, should a university, they ask, be governed by the same principles of the First Amendment as the public forum is? And I say, no, the principle should be even greater. There should be even more freedom of speech at universities than in public squares. What better place than a university to allow people to explore every aspect of their ideas, not to be constrained in any way by censorship or language control. And if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. A university is a place to explore ideas, not to accept conventional constraints. And, you know, the young men and women, students particularly, who insist on being treated as adults when it comes to the sexuality, when it comes to drinking, suddenly when it comes to politics and free speech, they run to Big Daddy and Big Mommy, the dean and the president, and they say, please, 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 we're children, protect us from free speech. Create a shelter for us. We can't stand the idea that there's a Confederate flag flying at Harvard. It doesn't allow me to study and work, a black woman said last year, to know that a Confederate flag is flying on the dormitory of one particular student at Harvard. Grow up. You're in a university. If you lived in South Carolina, the Confederate flag would be flying from the State House. Oppose it when it comes to a state legislature. But you're in a major university. You can't be so thin-skinned as to expect that everything is going to go your way. Life's not that easy, and a university is a training ground for real diversity. And, you know, when I teach students at Harvard, I keep telling them, you're not in the real world. I ask students in my class, how many of you favor the death penalty? And maybe 10% raise their hand. How many of you oppose it? 90% raise your hand. Then I tell them, in the real world, 86% of Americans favor the death penalty, and only 10 or 12% oppose it. If you're going to be a real lawyer out there, you're going to have to deal with juries that are not replicated in the classes at Harvard Law School. And so you darn well better hear views that are offensive to you, that you don't like, because those are the views that many Americans hold out there. And if you want to be a good lawyer, you have to know how to oppose those, not by censorship, but by more speech.
Why did you first decide to go into law school?
I don't think I had a choice. When I was a kid, everybody told me I had a good mouth, but not a very good head. In fact, my high school yearbook described me as having a mouth of Webster and a head of clay, and they didn't mean Henry. And my rabbi in yeshiva, where I went to high school, said to me, you should do something where you have to use your mouth and not your brain. You should either become a conservative rabbi — I went to an Orthodox school, so that was the biggest put down the rabbi could come up with — or I should become a lawyer. And I didn't want to be a rabbi, so I had to be a lawyer. I had no choice. I was always a verbal street fighter. And I'm one of these lawyers who never, ever wanted to be a judge. I couldn't abide the notion of being a judge, even a justice of the Supreme Court. The idea of shifting from being an athlete to an umpire just has no appeal to me at all. I was born an advocate. I love advocacy, and I love what I'm doing.
You know, you were in the top of your class in Harvard Law School.
Yale.
Were you a very competitive student?
I was a very competitive student. I'm a very competitive person. I'm totally non-competitive at home with my family and with my friends. But in my professional life, I'm competitive. I'm aggressive. I'm confrontational. The book is an in-your-face book. I mean, it's a direct challenge to justices of the Supreme Court, to lawyers. That's what I enjoy doing.
Do people ever find it obnoxious when you're that in your face?
People always find it obnoxious. I mean, I'm a designated obnoxious professor. I mean, that's part of my job. I like provoking. I don't make people happy. You know, I used to get a lot of letters from colleges and universities asking me to become a dean or a president, and I used to send them my Groucho Marx letter saying I would never want to be associated with any school that would have the poor judgment to want me to be the dean or the president of the university. I don't bring people together. I don't make nice. I don't soothe and massage people. I confront them. That's my job as a teacher.
In 1963 to 64, you clerked with Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, and I think that was his first year on the court?
No, his second year. I was picked by him during his first year, but I actually served in his middle year. He was only on the court for 3 years, and it was a wonderful experience.
Can you give me a sense of what you learned from him?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing I learned mostly was how to be a compassionate lawyer. He would always, and the judge I clerked for before him, Judge David Bazelon, would always talk about not only the writ of habeas corpus, but the writ of rachmanis. What rachmanis is a Hebrew Yiddish phrase for compassion. And these were activist judges who saw their mandate as doing justice. And there was always a technical way to do justice if you had the will to do it. Cutting through legal technicalities, being the master of the legal system rather than just an agent of the legal system, was their constant message. And remember, Arthur Goldberg was a great, great lawyer before he was ever nominated to the Supreme Court. There is not a single justice in the Supreme Court today who was a great practicing lawyer before they got on the Supreme Court. We have a Supreme Court of relative mediocrities. We had a great law professor, Antonin Scalia. But beyond that, if you just look at the other eight justices, none of them had really reached a level of the kind of distinction that other countries demand when they put people in their high courts, other Western democracies, whether it be Canada or New Zealand or England or Israel or France. We have a very mediocre Supreme Court by the levels of other Western democracies, and it's a tragedy.
If you think our Supreme Court is mediocre, has that done anything to change your faith in America's judicial system?
Oh, I have faith in America's judicial system largely, as I write in my book, because it includes the jury. If we only had judges, I'd have very, very little faith in our legal system. When you have a president of the United States who's willing to get on national television with a straight face and say that Clarence Thomas is the most qualified American in the United States to serve on the Supreme Court, that doesn't even pass the giggle test. I mean, George, you know, watch my lips, read my lips. That's just not true. You can't persuade anybody of that.
Have you ever been really disappointed by a jury?
Oh, yeah, of course. Rodney King was a very disappointing jury verdict. The acquittal of the murderer of Rabbi Meir Kahana here in New York City. Juries make mistakes all the time, but I think generally they make honest mistakes. The difference between juries and judges is judges sit on thousands of cases. They get cynical. They just want to get the case going. For a jury, it's their only shot at doing justice. Very few people have ever served on more than one jury. And I think they try very, very hard. And you can't whisper to a jury. Whatever you say to a jury is a matter of public record. And I suspect that many people whisper to many judges. There is a great deal of corruption in the American judiciary. It's not cash corruption, but the old boy and the old girl system operates and is alive and well in the United States of America today. People call judges. Judges owe people favors. Judges want to get promoted. And so they want to ingratiate themselves with lawyers who have power. Lawyers can get great favors from judges. We still have not eliminated the problem of corruption. We've eliminated the problem of cash payments for the most part, but not of power exchanges, which is just as corrupting an influence.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Alan Dershowitz is the author of the new book, Contrary to Popular Opinion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.